Welcome to another episode of Review Improve, a podcast dedicated to personal and practical growth in the 21st century. I'm your host, Sam Rust, along with my co-host, Mr. Bradley Luce. Bradley rolls off the tongue for an intro. It makes you seem more important. How are you today, good sir?
I am good. I am well. And either one works. I have people calling me Bradley because they see that on my name tag and they're like, all right, Bradley. And I'm like, no, it's Brad. They're like, no, it's Bradley. So either one. How are you? How was Thanksgiving?
It was excellent. I got very full. I ate much meat and many pies, which was very good. It was a good Thanksgiving.
Whole pies. A plural of pie.
Yeah, I think Becca and I ate a whole apple pie together over the course of about a 24-hour period. It was so good. Love Thanksgiving.
The question is, did you help, based off our last episode, did you help cook any of this food?
I did.
Oh,
I cooked.
Good job.
I did the turkeys. That was my purview. And everybody, we had a family over and everybody was complimenting me on the turkey job. So this is going somewhere, trust me. But then somebody there said, well, it's only good because you put good stuff on it, like butter.
That's the way it usually works.
Duh. Of course you put good stuff on it to make taste good. It doesn't have any bearing. It's like I had somebody else tell me the other day, well, you only know so much because you read a lot. Sue me? I don't know.
Usually works, yeah.
So anyways, apparently I'm a good cook if I use good ingredients.
The question is, did you barbecue it, deep fry it? Did you put it in the oven?
So I watched YouTube videos of deep frying turkeys, and I decided that I didn't want to incinerate my entire house. So I ended up smoking them. We have a Traeger, and so we did a couple of different brines. We did a buttermilk brine, 8 hours on the smoker. How about you? What'd you do for your turkey?
We put it in the oven. For like 5 or 6 hours.
Low and slow. That's the key.
It was good. It is good. We still have a lot.
It is. Yeah, I think we're going to be eating turkey for the next 3 weeks. So which is okay. That's a good thing to have a lot of leftovers.
All right. So 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Why did we choose this book, Sam? Why?
I wanted to read this book because this is one of the better known self-help books. In the space. It was originally written in 1989 by an author named Stephen Covey, taught at several universities in the Salt Lake City area, and did his doctoral thesis on basically the self-help genre of books over the last 200 years and studied how the principles or the guidelines laid out in that type of literature changed starting in about the 1920s. And so after reading all of that and doing an in-depth study and going into business himself with a consulting firm, after about 30 years in the space, kind of distilled down his own philosophy and really what I think he would say, it's less of his philosophy than it is a timeless philosophy of highly effective people. There's been a couple of revisions since 1989. The one that I read, I think, was written in like 2007, or that was updated in 2007, but it sold over 1 million copies, very well known. I would imagine that a lot of our audience has at least heard of this book. Some of them may have read it. So because it was a little bit more on the popular side and seemed to be referenced by several books that we've read up to this point, wanted to dive in and see what we could glean from it.
I've heard the title a lot, but I've never actually looked into it. And I have to say, for me at least, it started out a little slow, but that was probably just an introduction, which I actually started getting the application. I was like, all right, here we go. I really like
it. I thought it'd be helpful to start out with what the 7 habits are. The way that Stephen breaks them down is really into 3 categories. The first 3 are more internal focused. They are to be proactive, begin with the end in mind, and put first things first. And then the progression is once you've kind of mastered some of those internal things and become more outward focused for the next 3, which are think win-win, then seek first to understand, then to be understood. And then 6 is synergize, which as a side note, I think that this book might be kind of the beginning of synergy. in as a popular business term. We hear that all the time. We just need to identify our synergies. We need a synergistic culture. And I kind of think it might come from this book. And then the seventh one kind of wraps around all of them. He terms it sharpening the saw, but basically continually working on your own personal development, continually learning and growing, and that will, you know, play into the first six habits. So that was, you know, those are the seven habits. You know, after reading it, I really enjoyed the book from a couple of different angles, but probably first of all, that it was a book of principles. He's trying to identify principles that are timeless. He calls them natural laws, that when society comes closer to mirroring those natural laws and recognizing them and operating under them, that society is more productive, more harmonious, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. What was your takeaway? You know, why this has been such a popular book?
Well, I could see how he really laid the foundation for all of the quote unquote self-help or this is what successful people do books these days. I can see a lot of the books that we have ourselves have been going through take one chapter from this book and go deeper into it. Essentialism goes into chapter 3. Eat That Frog goes into habit 2. So, and I know we haven't gone through it, but getting to yes, the think win-win goes through habit 4. It's a book about negotiation, finding a reasonable ground for everyone to be happy with. He really laid a strong and deep foundation with this book, gathering information from all around the world and from like ages past and what has been learned about being effective and successful. And he really, like I said before, he really laid a good foundation and really opened people's eyes of, oh, these are what we can do. This is what we need to be learning and teaching ourselves rather than all these quick fix on the surface aspects that people are focusing on these days.
I really liked his definition of a habit. He says the definition of habit is the intersection of knowledge, skill, and desire. I think that's the three-legged stool of a habit. You have to know what you want to do. You have to have the skill to be able to do it and the desire to want to do it. And so I think that's important that you start really basic when you're considering the seven habits, because if you're missing one or more of those elements, it's not going to become a habit.
So yeah, as he's talking about habits and growing and changing, he's like, did you ever consider how ridiculous it would be to try to cram on a farm, to just like forget or choose not to plant in the spring, play all summer, and then cram in the fall to bring in the harvest? The farm is a natural system. The price must be paid and the process must be followed. And this point he's making is with habits, with changing things in your life for the better, there's no shortcuts. You have to start from the beginning. You have to take the steps necessary to make those changes and to form these habits. So then you will respond and act in the correct ways when the time comes to harvest what you've been sowing. You always reap what you sow. There's no shortcut.
Yeah. And he really speaks to the importance of persistence and taking a long-term view of things. And that comes out in his study that he conducted on the last 200 years of self-help literature. You know, he would say that over the last 50 years or 60 years now, about 75% of the success literature was really heavy on what he termed social image consciousness or quick fixes. That really would address the symptoms of the problems, but wouldn't necessarily go deep and uncover the root issues. In contrast to literature from the time period like 1770s to the 1920s, was all focused on what he called the character ethic, where the foundation for success was in timeless principles like integrity, simplicity, industriousness, courage, you know, more character traits such as those. And he kind of built up a dichotomy that we've gone away from emphasizing character and we have started emphasizing personality. And personality is really a matter of perspective and it's not an objective reality. It's more postmodernistic. And that really was interesting to me to have him distill it down that way. I don't know. What were your thoughts as you were reading through that section?
As he talked through the different personality versus character, he really started going down to the root cause of what makes the difference between those two. And it turns out, as he's saying, and if we really distill it down to the basics, is the way you view the world, the paradigms of your thoughts, your beliefs, and what values you hold, or not values, what he calls as principle. He says that principles are the thing that help you react in the ways you react, or make you react in the ways you react, the way that you decide to see the world through. He's like, principles are not values. A gang of thieves can share values, but they are in violation of the fundamental principles that we're talking about. The principles are what makes character, what makes personality, basically. That's what I'm trying to say. Long way about it.
Yeah. Yeah, they're guidelines, as he puts it. This is directly from his book. Principles are guidelines for human conduct that are proven to have enduring, permanent value. They're essentially unarguable because they are self-evident. And, you know, I think that that's important, that we recognize that there are these character traits. There are these fundamental realities that even today in our society that wants to redefine almost everything, that you just can't redefine. You can't redefine, and you can't escape the fruits of either ordering your life by honesty, by integrity, by courage, and modeling after the opposite. The fruit will be what it will be in those situations. And so, he kind of, to sum all that up, he really pushes on the audience, on his readers, the importance of basing your life around principles rather than your own personality or your own paradigm. He spends quite a bit of time talking about your own paradigm. He says, ultimately, paradigm is like a map that somebody has drawn of a territory. It may be correct, it may not be, and it's going to be influenced heavily by the perspective of the person that drew the map. But ultimately, a principle is more like what the United States of America actually looks like from space. You can't change that. That's a fundamental, unchanging reality. And so we need to be working to change our paradigms to fall more closely into line with reality, not accepting our paradigms as reality and working to make reality conform to our paradigm, if that makes sense.
He said, the more we take responsibility for those paradigms, examine them, test them against reality, listen to others, and be open to their perceptions, we get a larger picture and a far more objective view in the correct viewpoint of the way things are.
So we've talked quite a bit about the character ethic versus the personality ethic and principles. But getting into the habits themselves, what habit stood out to you the most and why?
And this goes right into how I just kind of ended it. The habit 5 is what stood out to me the most, is, and probably because this is, in today's society, is so rare, is seek to first understand, then be understood. And as the world today goes farther away from working together and more of a authoritative mindset, meaning that, like, I am right, you are wrong. Like, if it comes down to it, I'm going to make you see it my way no matter what. And I think that this habit is super important for us to make practice to do and actually make a like consistent thought and even remind ourselves to do. The common practice today, as it has been throughout history, and with the internet these days even more so, for people to listen not to understand, but to instead listen only so they can respond appropriately, quote unquote, how they think is appropriate. So what he says we need to do, and I totally agree with this, is empathetic listening. And I totally agree. He says, listen with your ears, but also listen with your eyes and heart. It's meaning, don't be browsing your phone while listening to someone talk, or no looking around, seeing what other people do in the room, or just completely focus on them and what they are saying. And this is something, ever since I read this, I'm trying to make more conscious effort to do this in different situations, especially at like work, where there's just so much going on. There's so many distractions, phones ringing, texts going off, emails coming in, instant messaging on the computer, people walking up, asking questions, people walking by and calling out hi. Just something I'm really, I think as we see how much input is coming into our lives these days, the more difficult this is going to be. But I really like what he had to say, where in order to really understand where someone's coming from, you need to listen the correct way. And you can't do that unless you have a conscious objective to do that. And then once you can start listening to people, you can start understanding where they're coming from and why they're doing and saying the things they are. And then you can even go further and help find solutions that are a win-win for everyone involved, that are actually long-lasting, that will actually solve issues rather than just putting a Band-Aid over these deeper-rooted problems.
Yeah, I think that you're right in that habit number 5, seek first to understand and then to be understood, is the one that's most neglected out of this list of 7 in the world today. And it was a good reminder for me the importance of seeking that out. We interact, even whether it's through social media or in person, we're still interacting with other people constantly. And to really achieve an impact, to be able to have an impact on those people's lives and for them to have an impact on your life, the first step is going to be understanding. He uses some optical illusions to make his point. You know, there's some classic studies with the picture of the young woman that may be an old woman, and it depends on which image you saw first. And then when you combine the images, you know, half the people in the room are going to think of the young woman and half are going to see the old woman. And watching those groups of people work to understand where the other half is coming from, it's a famous study that was done at Harvard, and he's implemented it in some of his own curriculum. But just this idea that we need to seek understanding and that we can't just automatically shout from the rooftops our opinion or our stance and expect for that to be completely acknowledged and understood, I think is really important, whether it's in the political avenue or in the workplace. I really enjoyed the put first things first. I think that was my favorite of all of them. You know, we've in the books that we've reviewed, you know, thinking of 10X, or even Eat That Frog, some of the other productivity-faced books. Essentialism, there is either implied or even talked about in some degree of detail in all of those books, this idea that you need to define what you're being effective in. Because you can be 100% effective, and if you pick the wrong things, it's not going to profit you anything. And so this is a little sneak preview to my application, but I really want to work at making sure that I'm orienting my life around the right activities.
Yeah, that was a good one. Something that a lot of people, like you said, don't do. And he talked a lot about PC over P, I think it was, or production over production capacity, meaning that you can't increase production capacity unless you at first focus on the product, where you got to take care of the machine. You got to oil the gears. You got to, if you're talking about yourself, you got to get the right amount of sleep. And if you don't put that first things first, then your production is never going to go up. And so you got to make sure that you're focusing the right things with your time, money, resources, focus, so then you can actually increase your production.
I liked how he structured the 7 habits in grouping them first, working on yourself, working on the individual, and then from that, working on, you know, that aspects of your character, of your person that are going to come into play in the public arena. What did you think of that balance?
I liked it. I thought it was interesting how he actually said that he didn't actually teach them in the order that they are in the book, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I saw that too. That was interesting.
But I did like how he focused. He again, it goes back. He's like, unless you really know what your principles are that you're going to base your life actions off of, and then you make sure that you are taking care of the most important thing, your body, your mind, first, you're not going to be able to go out and get the, understand where other people are coming from. You're not going to be able to go out and find win-win solutions, because if you're not grounded in and you don't know what your principles are to base your actions and decisions off of, when you go to seek to understand other people, you're going to be swayed by stuff. And so then you're just going to be all over the board. You're going to hear something from them and you're like, oh yeah, I need to make decisions based off that. And then you go to seek to understand someone else, you're going to be swayed by them. So you're just going to be all over the board. He's like, so you can't really understand where other people are coming from if you don't know where you are to begin with. And then if you can't seek to understand people, and if you're not taking care of yourself and putting the first things first, I'm just using your, like, taking care of your body and your mind stuff as one example. There's plenty of examples out there. Then you're not going to be able to find win-win situations, because you don't know what your win will be. You can't say, they'll say, yeah, this is my win. What's your win? You won't know because you'll be so torn up or war ragged or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I think you have to have the capacity to be effective before you can actually work at being more effective with other people. If you yourself are not effective in what you're trying to accomplish, it doesn't matter how much you think about win-win or synergy. It's just not going to happen because you don't have the PC, the production capability to make it happen. And we've talked about this in several other episodes as well, but taking personal responsibility and working and moving to a state of independence is really important. But really the master arc of this book is about moving to a state of interdependence. So we're all born into a state of dependence. The first three habits really are designed to put us on our trajectory to independence. But then the last three that focus more on the public arena really hammer home this idea that we are at our most effective, not when we're completely independent, but when we're interdependent, when we're working together with other people to make the sum greater than the parts. And I thought that was very well put by Stephen Covey, and I enjoyed reading his thoughts on that concept that interdependence is really important. I mean, you think about the three public habits, think, win, seek to understand, then to be understood, and then synergize. They all require participation from others, not just yourself. That's not something that you can go and just pull off on your own.
Yeah. And then going from interdependence, while he's talking about that, he dives into the subject that he calls emotional bank accounts, and why this is an important aspect to think about and consider as you go along with your relationships and day-to-day activities. Have you heard that statement before and his thoughts on that? Have you kind of heard stuff like that before when going from interrelationship?
I have run across that. I like that idea that you're either putting deposits in or you're having a negative impact on your balance with different people. I do think that's a helpful analogy. As with all analogies, it will fall short. But this idea that we want to make sure that we're having a positive impact and that we're building our relationships up in such a way that we can have impact and they can impact us, which isn't going to happen if we're constantly running people down, if we're asserting our own dominance, or if we're convinced we're always right.
Yeah, I've actually heard this mostly about marriage relationships. Basically, where your emotional bank account is a metaphor that describes the amount of trust that has been built up in that relationship. It's a feeling of safeness you have with another human being. If you do not put time and effort into your relationship with your spouse, then there will never be any trust, uniformity, unity, safe feelings that you need to have in times of stress or trouble, such as financial trouble or family issues. But I've never really heard it extended past into other relationships. After reading what he said, it now kind of makes a lot of sense where, it's every relationship you have. I can think of relationships I have and have had in the past where people have invested time and effort and care into my life. So I trusted them when they gave me advice or told me I needed to change something or do something better. But I've also had relationships then and now where actions and words from the individuals tell me that they don't care about me as a person, have no interest or intentions of understanding me or where I come from. And so then, with those, the latter people, they have an actual negative bank account with me in my life, put it in a real world term. I love the Emerson quote he used at one point. And when at my previous job as a manager at a company, I had this in bold letters hanging on my office wall, right at eye level. So when you walked through my door, it was the first thing you saw. The quote by Emerson says, "What you do speaks so loudly, I cannot hear what you say." And one point that Stephen Covey made was your actions have to really match your words or your bank account will never go anywhere. Your emotional bank account with people. Small discourtesies, little diskindnesses, little forms of disrespect. Those all make large withdrawals, even if you are saying, "Oh, I love you. I care for you. I'm going to help you." The actions will actually take larger withdrawals out than your words will actually put in.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed his section on emotional maturity, because it does take a pretty high level of understanding of other people, or emotional maturity. It takes a very high level of emotional maturity to be able to recognize these emotional bank accounts, as it were, and recognize how you are building people up or how you are tearing them down. The definition was, quote, the ability to express one's own feelings and convictions balanced with consideration for the thoughts and feelings of others. You know, that I've pondered that quite a bit since I read that, and want to continue to grow in my own emotional maturity and my ability to recognize the impact that I'm having on other people, and continually try to steer that towards the positive side, and continue to excise the negative parts of how I'm impacting those around me.
That takes a lot of work, and the whole thing to work on those accounts and just everything we've been talking about takes a lot of work. I mean, when you think about relationships are a lot of work. It's good work. But even going further to consider all of this bank account stuff really puts a full impact of what each little action does, what each little word does, no matter how small you think it actually is.
Yep. Completely agree with that. You know, kind of the last concept that we wanted to touch on was this idea of how do we process or handle the space between stimulus and our response. You know, in both this emotional maturity and this how do we handle the space between stimulus and response really comes into play with habit number two, which is begin with the end in mind. You know, if we want something, how that's going to define how we react either to a person or to something completely external that has happened to us. You know, how are we going to process that? And so, you know, pivoting from the emotional maturity standpoint to more of the stimulus and response, and how do we handle that? I don't know. How do you personally handle it now, and how does that line up with what Covey writes about in chapter three there?
Personally, right now, I do a lot of planning. So I try and foresee what people's responses are going to be, so then I can kind of base my action. I already kind of know, have a plan of what I'm going to say or do. But as I was reading this, I never, like, that's just something I usually, that's how my paradigms are right now of looking at what different reactions might be and trying to foresee stuff that might happen. But again, that makes me see their response through my glasses. It doesn't make me see their response through their glasses. So I've never really considered too much like what I'm actually doing with that. But I like how he reiterates that you control your response. So like I control my response, and how I use that time between the space between the stimulus and response is up to me. He's like, you can use it to light the fuse in your brain for all that war, or I can use it to trigger the compassion and to seek to understand the mindset that will help the situation for the better. Difficult part is the time between the stimulus and response will vary depending on the situation. Sometimes you have as long as you want, such with like email or text. But other time you might have someone walk in your office and then you have to respond just like that. But what he says you can do is train your mind in how to respond in certain situations. So if you know that you struggle with impatience in the workplace, do some role playing in your mind. Like, all right, imagine someone coming into your office door heated, and then try and work through that in a keeping yourself not heated. I mean, we can all think of times where there's a situation that just gets our blood pressure high and our blood pumping. So he said, use those thoughts that you can get your blood pressure high and to think through, oh, I need to think through this differently, so then I don't respond in that way. He gave an example, and I really like it, in that he and his wife will actually role play different situations where their kids are misbehaving. So they already have a response ready if that time comes. They can work on ways that they might be falling short in their responses, and just so they can walk through different situations, so then they're ready for a plethora of different stimulus, and so they can hit the response they want every time. But he really stresses that we need to look ahead and walk ourselves through different situations that we struggle in so that we can grow and change our responses in the actual moment. So I really like that whole.
So I think what I heard you say in all that is that how Donald Trump responds to stimulus with tweeting is the way to go. Is that what did I hear you right there?
I'm not going to respond. I don't know how political we want to get in this podcast. I neither deny nor confirm what you just said. I'm going to go tweet about it right now.
And you're going to go tweet about it? Yeah, good for you. Good for you. In one specific area that really matters is after a mistake. So if the stimulus is a mistake, how are we going to respond to that? I see that in my life when I make a mistake, which happens fairly routinely. You know, am I going to dwell on that? Am I going to let that affect my performance, whether it's on the frisbee field or playing piano or, you know, whatever the case may be? Or am I going to be able to acknowledge the mistake, learn from it, and move on pretty quickly? I think that that's an area where you can really quickly see how do I handle stimulus when the stimulus is a mistake? And can you acknowledge that, learn from it, and move on pretty quickly, and your responses, your future responses, aren't colored by that past mistake in a negative way? I think that that's a really important subset of stimuli that is important for all of us to be keeping an eye on and keep ourselves accountable to a good response to our own mistakes.
Yeah, and that's something that I know, like, I struggle with and a lot of people struggle with is learning from our mistakes, because when you do hit a mistake, or if someone else makes a mistake, our first response is to get defensive or reason it out, give some reasoning why it happened or why it's okay or something. So I did like that too, where he's like, hey, we use these times to learn. I know we all say that, use your mistakes to learn. But if we look at the data, how many of us actually learn every single time we make, or even admit that, yeah, that was a mistake that I shouldn't have had.
I think that's an area that I know I want to improve in. So won't speak for the rest of the listening audience, but for me, myself and I will be working on that. So as we kind of wind down here, as you read the book, Brad, was there anything that you would have wanted to ask Stephen Covey after reading the
book? Yeah. So there was one main question I would have, So I read the second edition where he actually answers the top questions he's asked about the content in the book and what his thoughts are on different things. But one thing I couldn't find in there was what happens when you're seeking to understand, but when the other party doesn't care about understanding your side, or even like doesn't care that you're trying to do that. And I know, and he says, he touched on this a little, saying that as you seek to understand other people, they will usually lower their barriers and a positive synergy will be created. But there are some occasions where no matter how hard you try, the other person doesn't want to work as a team, so to speak, or they don't even want to try considering to understand your thoughts or helping you understand their thoughts. So I was curious what he would say about that, what his thoughts would be on that. Is it best just to do the best you can yourself to understand where they're coming from and proceed from there? Or is it just best to conduct business and then leave? I know I kind of got a good idea based on what he said in the book and what he said answer to those questions, but it would be fun to ask him that. How about you?
Yeah, I really enjoyed that section on, you know, some of the most commonly asked questions that he got. I would have loved to have known how he implemented habit number 7. What did he personally do for personal development and sharpening his saw? Obviously as part of his doctrinal thesis, he's consuming a ton of content, coming up with this book and ultimately the Franklin Covey Institute, and has had a big impact in the business world. But for him personally, what did he enjoy, and how did he hone his own toolbox? I would have loved to have asked him that. Brad, would you recommend this book? And if so, why?
Yeah, I would. I would recommend it to everyone, just because it's a very insightful book and very helpful book. I think this would set a good foundation for everyone trying to change or just become better at what they do. But especially to like high school and college graduates, or someone who's starting a big chapter in life, be it marriage or a new career. I think it'd be good just at the outset of something big to go through this, even for myself. Say I down the road, start a new job, just go through it again and remind myself of 7 things that are highly important to focus on and make sure I do. Yeah, I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, I would also recommend it. I found the book to be a great mix of practical help, practical examples, but also had sections that were a little bit more theoretical that caused a little bit more deep thinking, as I term it. But it was a really good balance, and it was definitely very, in the whole, a book that you can really apply to your life. I really enjoyed the plethora of parenting examples that he uses. And then he takes that parenting example and then shows how that would impact you in a business setting or some other setting. But as a father myself, I found that to be really helpful, and caused me to ponder some of the ways that I parent and some of the areas that I want to grow in, especially as my kids are getting a little bit older and, you know, having more of a back and forth relationship with them where they're able to start understanding some of these concepts, and definitely want them to be growing in their ability to be proactive, to put the first things first, and to seek to understand other people. Explaining that to a 5-year-old, it's a little bit different than you and I sitting here and talking about it on a podcast, but I'm excited about that challenge, and this book will be helpful for me in furthering my development as a father and as a business person as well. So I would greatly recommend it to really everyone, like you said. Any final thoughts on 7 Habits of Highly Effective People?
I honestly, like I said, it started out, at least for me, a little slow, but once you really get into it, there's something in every single chapter that really grabs you. And he said, I really like in the beginning of the book, he said, you can read this book from front cover to back cover, or you can just jump in and read one habit. He's like, you don't have to read whole thing. Standalone habits, but a comprehensive book. So I really like that, because it will be easier down the road to jump in and be like, all right, I need reminders on sharpening the saw. So you can jump in there and find some aspects. He goes through, he says, talks about your sharpening your mind, sharpening your body, sharpening your interpersonal skills, your just what you're good at, what you're bad at, stuff like that. So I really like that. It'll be easier to jump in. I think everyone should read it through front to finish to begin with, and then just take time to go through different habits at least once a year.
What was your application that you came away with?
I touched on this before, kind of like was I soapboxed earlier with habit number 5, but it's a combination of seek to understand before I seek to be understood. And as a result of that, bring about more win-wins, because I can think of, and I'm sure we all can, situations every day where you're trying to get something, another person's trying to get something, whether it be just help on a project or a solution implemented for an issue or the idea to be submitted to management, something or other. There's always situations where, even with time management, where there's going to be a win-lose or lose-lose. So I want to seek to understand where people are coming from, so then I can help bring about more win-wins. And there's so many positive aspects to that, more than, I don't think there's any negative aspects to that. But the quote he says, where the successful person has a habit of doing the things that failures don't like to do. They don't like doing them either necessarily, but their disliking is subordinated to the strength of their purpose. And I think that sums up the main point of the book and kind of what I want to take away with the win-win and seek to understand, because those two things as humans, it's difficult to do, because we always want to be first. We want to win. We want other people to understand us rather than us understand them.
I appreciate that. I completely agree. My application, I spoke to this again closer to the top of the podcast, but I really want to take habit number 3. Putting the first things first. Both you and I, Brad, are pretty busy. We have a lot of things that we enjoy doing, a lot of things that we have to do, whether that's family or church or business or this podcast or other real estate endeavors. And in all of that, I want to make sure that I am prioritizing and putting the right things first. Continue. That's something that I want to re-examine. We're getting to one of my favorite times of the year with the holidays and New Year's. I'm a big New Year's resolution guy. And I like to spend the month of December, you know, really looking back over what happened in 2018. How was I stretched? How did we grow as a family? And what do we want to pursue in 2019? And I'm going to include this as a big part of that process, is what put those first things first. Well, with that, that wraps up our review of the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Please leave us a comment or review if you enjoyed this episode or one of our other episodes as well. And we'll have a link in the show notes where you can buy this book on Amazon. It's also available on Audible. Again, would highly recommend picking up a copy of this book. Our next book that we're going to be going towards is Measure What Matters by John Doerr. It's a book on statistics and goal setting, and how organizations as diverse as Google, Microsoft, and Bono have achieved greatness through what they call OKRs and measuring what matters and creating transparent goals that can be communicated really to the world and throughout an organization. So I am looking forward to getting into that. That book comes highly recommended, but I have not read it yet. So I am looking forward to reading it and dissecting it with you on our next episode, Brad. With that, we just released on Spotify. So thank you to those of you who are giving us a listen on that new platform. We're also available on podcast.com, iTunes, Stitcher, and most other places where podcasts are available. So again, we love listener feedback. If you have a book that you'd like us to review in the future, please reach out to us. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn as well. So with that, this is your host, Sam Rust, signing off. Until next time.